Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Kenneth Nackbar of Morris Nichols Archton Tunnel here on behalf of appellees. With me at council table, John Rolke and Anthony Van Vuren of the law firm of Clifford Chance. Mr. Rolke has been admitted pro hac vice and with the court's permission will be arguing on behalf of appellees this morning.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Carmela Keener of Rosenthal, Monheit and Goddess on behalf of the plaintiff below, appellant. With me is Christopher Hinton of the Hinton Law Firm. Mr. Hinton has been admitted pro hoc vice and will make the presentation today on behalf of the appellant.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Ready to proceed?
May it please the court, Christopher Hinton of the Hinton Law Firm on behalf of the appellant, plaintiff below. The complaint here is fact-rich because of the nature of the business that the company is engaged in. Municipal Mortgage was involved in issuing tax-exempt debt and tax credit syndication. These businesses are entirely unrelated to the single-family subprime lending that is currently subject of current reports. In fact, the company's assets, as alleged by plaintiff, were in deterioration by 2002. Before the Chancery Court, counsel for defendants opened his oral argument by providing that the company has been and continues to be a successful investment for its shareholders. You will not be hearing that today. He further asserted that the restatement process that the company has been engaged in for over 2 years did not involve the tax-exempt debt portfolio. You will not hear that either today. Defendant further said that plaintiff was the only one complaining of the purported improper conduct in the accounting for the tax debt. You will not hear that either today, as there are now 10 federal securities lawsuits and 2 derivative actions outside this jurisdiction currently pending. I want to focus my argument today on 2 areas that plaintiffs assert defendants are subject to substantial likelihood of liability and are therefore unable to consider demand. The first is the improper accounting for the tax-exempt debt portfolio. I want to first establish the backdrop which plaintiffs assert created significant red flags under which the Board of Directors reviewed the company's filings and considered the tax-exempt portfolio.
I think it might be easier for us to follow if you were to compress into a single paragraph what you contend the complaint alleges that would, if true, constitute a substantial likelihood of liability about which the directors were aware.
In connection with the complaint alleges with particularized facts that the defendants were aware that the tax-exempt bond portfolio was substantially overvalued, that the company had failed to properly take write-downs and had subsequently failed to properly consider and treat those assets and further disclosed misrepresentations concerning the true value of that asset. The backdrop under which the defendants were aware of the tax-exempt debt portfolio is significant here because it is in and of itself a public presented in numerous public filings that were executed by the defendants and that were reviewed by defendants. This is the case because the tax-exempt debt portfolio was the primary asset of this company. We're not talking about a small asset or one or few transactions that the Board of Directors may not have necessarily had to oversee or been subject to presentations concerning. This was the company's business. In fact, this was the company's business until the company made a decision that it would expand its business into the tax credit syndication because of the extensive poor performance of this portfolio. This portfolio was approximately $1.4 billion worth of tax-exempt debt.
Face value,
correct. The borrowers of the tax-exempt debt typically have lower credit worthiness and are higher risk profile. The company, in fact, had to seek out these borrowers because it had a substantial dividend. That dividend was, in fact, greater than the going interest rate that would have been earned on standard loans. The bond portfolio performance, the performance of the bond portfolio exhibited extensive deterioration beginning in 2002. Public documents, again, annual reports that were reviewed, signed, and executed by defendants and would have put defendants on notice of the seriousness of the decay were prevalent. The 2003 annual report, for example, provides, and it was in that report that they informed shareholders that they would be transferring to the tax credit syndication business because of the downward trend and the significant deterioration in the tax-exempt business. That annual report disclosed that there had been a decline from 2001 to 2003 in debt service coverage to only 1.04 times, meaning that on average, these as a whole, there was hardly enough income to actually cover debt service. During the 2003 to 2005 annual reports, there was a significant increase in unrealized losses from these bonds that had been in a continuous loss position for more than a year. In fact, it was $476 million of the $1.4 billion portfolio. That's a substantial percentage. Against this backdrop, as I'll reiterate and repeat throughout this, the loss through the other than temporary impairment that the company took was a measly $27 million. The 2005 annual report, again, evidence a significant increase between 2004 and 2005 of interest income not recognized from bonds on non-accrual status.
And before you leave that, part of this restatement that's been going on is to rectify what started with the $27 million loss. That, you know, to the extent that wasn't an accurate number, now the restatement is going to give them a more accurate number.
It's not so clear, unfortunately. The beginning of the restatement related to the tax credit syndication business, purportedly. And that was under which the defendants had previously represented to the court that the restatement, in fact, had nothing to do with the tax-exempt debt assets. And then, in fact, the tax-exempt debt assets were fairly valued and no write-downs would be taken. Again, you will not hear that again today. That has clearly changed.
What does the complaint allege was the role of the directors in deciding, the role of the directors, if any, in deciding how much of the unrealized bond portfolio losses to write down?
Okay. Against this backdrop, and the complaint has additional allegations which I set forth in the supplemental submission, which I appreciate the request and opportunity to have supplied that. The defendants here set forth and again executed the annual reports which set forth the standards upon which the company was reviewing and valuing these assets. The tax-exempt debt bonds were valued by references to the underlying property, meaning that the performance and cash flow of the property is a basis under which the bonds themselves can be valued.
I didn't ask how it was done. I'm asking what was the role of the directors in deciding how much to write down or not write down.
The audit committee duties, of which all but two of the disinterested directors were a part of, had as a principal duty to monitor the integrity of the financial reporting process and to monitor the company's compliance with legal and regulatory requirements. Clearly in this instance, and the complaint alleges such, that outside of the board of directors' actual knowledge, that the board of directors actually, under their watch, permitted the deterioration of the disclosures concerning the value of the tax-exempt debt portfolio.
And how would you characterize that as a breach of any duty or a breach of any operating agreement?
That aspect directly more goes to the knowledge, constructive knowledge of the defendants, that they made an affirmative, either they made an affirmative decision or the annual reports which they reviewed and executed contained data And this data, prior to 2002, contained information that would allow you, in large part, to value the underlying tax-exempt debt assets.
And you're telling us that it was the duty of the audit committee to decide how much to write down the bond portfolio?
It was the duty of the audit committee to ensure that there were adequate internal policies and controls that would lead to the accurate review and determination of the value of the tax-exempt debt. Not only did you have the decrease in the disclosures.
Okay, so what you're saying, if I understand it, is that somebody other than the directors may have made a wrong decision to not write down sufficiently the bond debt. And the audit committee should have been aware of that, either should have been aware of it or should have prevented it by having controls in place, but didn't. Is that?
That's in part correct.
Yeah, and my question is, assuming that, how would you characterize that duty and the breach of that duty? Is it a breach of the duty of loyalty, of care? Is it a breach of the operating agreement's standard of fraud or illegal activity?
Well, it's a breach of duty of loyalty in part, in that we allege with particularized facts that defendants knew or should have known that the processes were not being completed, and that certainly the results, because there certainly is the ability to rely on outside experts, but it only goes so far. And in this instance, there was a prevalent enough information that was before them that it was clear that the company's own policies, which they were aware of because, A, it was in part the audit committee's duty to establish those policies, and they were disclosing the financial reports that they signed off on. Those reports provided that the company was going through certain processes, when in fact the company was not. Despite the, in addition to the decrease in the impairment or the decrease in disclosures, the company failed to provide evidentiary backup to support not taking other than temporary impairments. They also provided failure to require to require evidentiary backup that would determine the likelihood of recoverability of these assets, which is significant because the sole basis that the company claimed that it was not taking an other than temporary impairment on these assets under FAS 1 Financial Accounting Standard 115 was an intent and ability to hold that asset. In order to have an intent and ability to hold that asset, you have to have an evidentiary support that provides a likelihood of recoverability as well. And that was not done here.
Well, I mean, just and I may be repeating the Chief Justice's question, is your claim here that the directors had a substantial likelihood of liability because the liability being for a breach of the Caremark duty of oversight?
Part of our claim goes to Caremark liability, but
I'm talking about in this regard.
In this regard, we allege certainly supports Caremark liability here, but we believe that independent of Caremark.
Let me simplify the question. The directors either knew that they should be writing down a larger amount and deliberately decided not to do it. That is, they directly affected that decision.
Right.
In which case we might have is a loyalty violation. Or they just simply walked away knowing that they should have done something in terms of instituting controls, but didn't.
Right.
In which case you've got possibly a Caremark liability. Which is it? That is, what are you alleging?
Right. The complaint pleads that the defendant directors did take affirmative steps with full knowledge to cause the company not to properly value these assets.
In other words, we know we should be marking these assets down, and we're deliberately not going to do
that. That's correct. That's correct. And again, one of the areas that is relevant here, not only because is the complaint pleads the company was not following its own policies, was the knowledge of the board of directors in connection with that. Beginning in 2003, the company disclosed that it would begin, that due to the declining performance of the tax-exempt debt portfolio, it would be, actually begin a campaign of selling individual bonds. So the selling of individual bonds, when opportunities presented itself, was an ongoing event, and by necessity involved the board of directors because of the way that these transactions occurred. And I fast forward to the MMA distressed portfolio sale auction results. And the reason I do that is because this is just another, it was a very large sale, $182 million, or 15% of the company's portfolio. And the results the results of that auction indicated, again, according to the company's policies, that $27 million was nowhere near the appropriate, other than temporary impairment here. Again, we have the actual underlying data that was provided in that, and much of that information was not too similar, or was actually similar to the information that had been disclosed in public reports up to 2002, which set forth the cash flow of these entities.
And in fairness, I should let you know you're into your rebuttal time. It's your option whether you want to save it or continue.
I'll save it. Thank you.
May it please the court. John Rolke from Clifford Chance on behalf of the defendant appellees. Good morning. This case, Your Honors, boils down to three things that the plaintiff claims that the company did wrong and that the board allegedly knew were wrong and failed to do anything about. First, she claims that the company improperly applied an accounting statistic that the complaint refers to as Financial Accounting Standard, or FAS 115. And evaluating some of the assets. Second, she claims that the company made charitable contributions to allegedly related entities who used those funds, according to the plaintiff, improperly to service debt held by the company. And third, she makes the unusual claim that the company improperly earned what she describes as enormous profits for shareholders through three transactions that the complaint identifies as improper asset transactions. Now, she claims that these transactions and accounting practices put the company at risk for tax code violations and overvalued certain assets to mislead shareholders. And she claims that the board's alleged failure to establish sufficient reporting and accounting controls exacerbated these problems and has led to a process through which the company is restating earnings. Now, with that backdrop, it's important to understand what this case is not about. This is not your typical Caremark oversight case where a lawsuit is filed after a regulator or a court has found that the company actually did something wrong, or where an employee or some other person is claimed to have brought allegedly wrongful conduct to the attention of the board and the board has failed to act. Instead, this is a case in which the plaintiff concedes that she is the first person to even suggest that the challenged transactions, challenge charitable contributions somehow violate the tax code, or that the company's application of FAS 115 overvalued some assets. But the issue here is not whether the company actually did something wrong. The question is whether the board should be given the opportunity to address the plaintiff's allegations through the pre-suit demand that the law requires. That inquiry is determined by whether the directors confront personal liability for consciously and in bad faith failing to address an act or omission that they knew was wrongful. Now, this question has to be answered in the context of what this court describes as the powerful presumptions to which directors are entitled under Delaware law. That is, absent well-pleaded facts to the contrary, directors are presumed to have acted in an informed basis and in good faith, and in the honest belief that the action they were taking was in the best interest of the company. Also must be made by reference to the fact that this plaintiff studiously avoided using the tools at hand that were available to her and deliberately electing not to make a books and records demand before she filed her complaint. By way, for example, she could have asked for the board meeting minutes or the audit committee meeting minutes or the audit committee reports. Even though she rests her claim based on public records that indicate there was an audit committee that worked with independent auditors, all of which indicate that there was information available to her that could have informed her claims, but she elected not to pursue that option. Now, we think that the legal framework for the analysis of whether there's personal liability starts with the company's operating agreement. That exculpates directors from any personal liability except when a director engages in fraudulent or illegal conduct or commits a bad faith breach of his or her implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. What that means is to excuse demand on the basis of director liability, she must allege specific facts that, if true, would establish that a majority of the board disregarded their fiduciary duties with a culpable state of mind. That is, they knowingly and in bad faith engaged in or allowed the company's alleged misconduct. Now, to get there, she's got to do at least, at a minimum, three things. She has to have specific facts that show that the directors had actual or constructive knowledge. Second, that knowledge indicated to the directors that the company was doing something illegal. And three, that in the face of that knowledge, the board didn't do anything about it. We think she fails on all three of those prongs. The most certainly doesn't allege any specific facts that shows that any director, much less a majority of them, had the requisite culpable state of mind. Let me first address the allegations that the board must have known that the company was misapplying FAS 115. She appears to be attributing that knowledge to the directors for what seems to be four different reasons, if I understand her pleadings and her complaint correctly. First, she claims that certain board members served on the company's audit committee and therefore should have known that the accounting statistic was being improperly applied. Now, we cite several cases in our papers that confirm that, for what we think are very good reasons, that mere membership on an audit committee is not a sufficient basis on which to infer culpable knowledge. She also seems to cite the annual reports that were signed by the directors or the SEC statements that they allegedly approved to the effect that the company's policy was to apply FAS 115. But the knowledge that the company's policy was to apply FAS 115 and knowledge that the company was improperly applying it, we submit, are two very different things. And with respect to the latter, there's no specific allegations in the complaint to establish that the board knew the company was improperly applying that statistic. Third, she claims that the company improperly applied FAS 115, or the board knew that it was being improperly applied, because the company stated that it had the intent and ability to hold these assets until their full value could be recovered, and that to rely on that as a sole basis for applying the statistic is improper. There's a couple of problems with that. The first of which is that the complaint is replete with company representations to the effect that it considered a lot of other factors when applying FAS 115. It was not the sole basis on which the company made a determination as to the value of certain assets. But most importantly, there's nothing in the complaint that establishes that the company didn't have the intent and ability to hold these assets until full value. She does not, for example, allege a single instance in which the company sold or disposed of an asset without recovering its full value. And the plaintiff would have found out, if she had made a books and records demand, that all the specific properties that she alleges in the complaint were, in fact, sold at or near full value, consistent with the application of the statistic.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's assume that the complaint alleges with particularity that the company was improperly applying FAS 115, but then goes on to say, and the directors, or a majority of the directors, knew that the company was misapplying FAS 115. Would that be sufficient in your view to overcome a Rule 23.1 motion?
Certainly, Your Honor. A conclusory allegation that the board knew the company was improperly applying FAS 115 would be insufficient under this court's rules and
well, standards. How does one particularize knowledge? That is, if it isn't enough to say that the directors knew that what was going on here was improper, how, in your view, is that fact supposed to be pled?
This court and Delaware law provides numerous kinds of tools that a plaintiff like this one can utilize in developing particularized facts sufficient to meet this pleading burden.
My question is, give me an example of a particularized pleading of director knowledge, other than that of an allegation that the directors knew.
I think those examples can be found in the cases that the plaintiff relies on in support
for
of
instance.
His contention. Okay. And that, for example, is they all involve particularized facts that the directors were aware of alleged misconduct because somebody brought it to their attention. There was a specific fact alleged. And, for example, she cites McCall v. Scott, where the board had alleged...
The government made them aware.
Exactly. The board, in that case, had notice of the alleged billing improprieties that were at issue there.
Okay, so if the complaint alleged that the company's outside accountants told the board that FAS 115 was being misapplied, that would be sufficient in your view?
If, perhaps, the facts also indicated that the board did not take adequate steps in response to that information.
Okay, well, that doesn't go to knowledge. That goes to a different element.
It goes to a different element, but precisely. Perhaps, yes.
So it's not enough to say the board knew, but it is enough to say that someone told the board?
That someone told the board and provided the sufficient basis on which it would be appropriate for this or some other court to conclude that information that was provided to the board gave it a sufficient basis to conclude that something wrong was going on. Something illegal was happening within the company, particularly under the facts of this case where the particular exculpation provision is quite broad and says you are exculpated from liability, board of directors, except if you've engaged in fraudulent or illegal conduct.
Okay, so what that might mean in plain English is that the accountant tells the board that 115 is being misapplied, and then the attorneys for the board say that as a consequence of that, you've overstated the value by X billions of dollars, and that might be viewed, that at least would be a sufficient basis for a 10b-5 lawsuit. That would be sufficient.
It's certainly closer to the facts on which courts have held that demand is excused based on personal liability. We do not have any such facts alleged in this complaint.
Any other examples of specific pleading going to the issue of director knowledge?
Well, In re Abbott Labs, another case where the plaintiff cites and relies on, there the directors knew that violations were occurring because the FDA had conducted investigations and site inspections and had told the board, had sent the board letters saying you are in violation of the law.
Okay, that's again the government telling the directors.
Is it part of the plaintiff's claim here that the reason the board didn't know and the reason they can't plead the specific facts that you've given examples for after Justice Jacobs' hypothetical is because the board didn't set up sufficient internal controls to get that information? Is that part of their claim?
I don't read that to be part of their claim. In fact, I read their complaint as proving too much on that score. They plead that the board had an audit committee. They plead that the audit committee considered and reviewed the way in which the accounting statistic was applied. They plead that the board was advised by management at one point in time that there were material weaknesses in the reporting controls. There was no utter lack of accounting controls or reporting controls at issue here. The complaint proves too much. It says that there was an audit committee. The audit committee relied on independent auditors, and the gravamen of their claim is not that the board didn't have those accounting and reporting controls in place. It's that they just got it wrong when they reviewed the transactions, and they should have.
And I understood Mr. Hinton to say that the complaint alleges that they didn't get it wrong inadvertently; they got it wrong intentionally.
I heard that as well when he made that comment, and I think he expressed it that they took affirmative steps. I've looked hard in this 84-some-odd page complaint, and I do not see any specific allegations as to what those affirmative steps were. It is insufficient as a matter of law to make the conclusory assertion that a director of a board took affirmative steps to mislead investors. You need some specific fact. What did the director do?
Well,
and this is the question Justice Jacobs was asking.
Does everyone agree that the 115 standard, FAS 115, was correctly applied? I mean, putting the allegations aside, with 2020 hindsight and the 20-some-month restatement, do we now know that everything was applied correctly?
Well, the interesting point about that, Your Honor, and the only thing we know about that, based on the records before the court, is that the plaintiff has put before the court a July 2007 statement released by the company that indicated that with respect to some of the assets that the plaintiff claims were overvalued through the application of FAS 115 were in fact undervalued. That is, to the extent there is any evidence before this court that FAS 115, that somebody has determined that FAS 115 in hindsight was inappropriately applied, it was to the effect that it undervalued the assets and not overvalued the assets.
We've been using your time with questions. Can you comment on the allegations concerning the related party transactions?
Yes, Your Honor. The claim there is that the company knowingly approved of related party transactions that resulted in enormous profits. The problem here is that the complaint, and what she says is you had knowledge that these transactions were improper because you approved them, board, or you were obligated under the operating agreement to approve them. Delaware law is very clear that mere board approval of something is not a sufficient basis on which to infer culpable knowledge. This court in Aronson was quite clear about that. Otherwise, it would render the pre-suit demand requirement meaningless. What the plaintiff seems to claim about these transactions is that that they were improper because the company earned enormous profits that they should have let the alleged related parties take from these transactions. And because they didn't let the alleged related parties take these profits, it somehow exposes the company to a tax code violation. Again, the plaintiff's the first person to raise that suggestion. It hasn't been substantiated in a court or by any regulator, by any government, by any accountant, any lawyer, any employee.
Does your statement that the company made enormous profits or profits from these transactions, does that appear in the complaint?
The characterization of them as enormous does come from the complaint, Your Honor.
Enormous profits.
Yes.
How do the comment on the allegation in the complaint that they were making these charitable contributions for the purpose of putting money in the hands of people that needed it?
Well, again, the crux of our defense with respect to that, Your Honor, is that there's nothing in the complaint that allows you to conclude that the board knowingly approved of charitable contributions, knowing that they were wrong, knowing that the complaint makes clear that the board itself does not decide where those charitable contributions go, B, the board does not decide how those charitable contributions are used by somebody who gets them, and C, there's nothing in the complaint that allows you to conclude that the board, even if it knew that the charitable contributions would be used to service debt, that was improper. In fact, the plaintiff's the only one that we know of in the entire world who has suggested that use of charitable contributions would be illegal or wrong.
Right, but we're talking about a motion to dismiss the complaint and reasonable inferences. And according to Mr. Hinton's brief, he's saying the board was aware that there were some problems with these loans and that the board decided to make specific charitable contributions to make money available so that the debt could be serviced and things would look better than they really were. Because if you can't pay your mortgage unless I give you money, then your problem hasn't gone away. I've just given you money that makes it appear your problem went away. So my question is, how do you characterize what he alleged, and why was it deficient?
Well, again, it's deficient because it lacks the details, the particularized facts that are required to show that the board knew that what it was doing when it approved of charitable contributions, even if you infer that they did approve, well, that they were wrong. There was something wrong about them. Because absent those particularized facts, absent proof that somebody said, board of directors, you better not let these charitable contributions be used to service debt because it's a violation of the tax code, right. Then there's a presumption.
What you said reminded me of something else I wanted to ask you because your light's on. You said if they knew. And then we have this exchange at the bench ruling by Vice Chancellor Lamb, and it's renewed in the briefs, that the board had to know because they were related transactions. That's a fair inference. Or if they didn't know that these related transactions were occurring, then somehow that was deficient board operation. But Mr. Hinton says Vice Chancellor Lamb assumed the opposite along the lines that you said. We don't even know if the board knew and didn't address the deficiency that might have occurred if related transactions were occurring without board knowledge.
Board approval of a transaction is not a sufficient basis on which to infer culpable knowledge. It does not automatically connote hostile interest or guilty participation by the directors.
Oh, I agree. My question is the reverse. You said if they knew, and my question is if there were related transactions going on, isn't that something the board would have known or should have known?
And Your Honor, for purposes of this argument, I can, and we may make this point in our brief, you can infer that the board knew about these transactions, that the board knew about charitable contributions were being made. That is a far cry from what she has to plead. That is to say that they knew when they did approve them that they were wrong. There was something illegal about them. And on that, the complaint is woefully deficient. Otherwise, my board has acted in good faith and with due regard for their fiduciary responsibilities, and there's nothing in the complaint to establish the contrary.
Well, do they have to show that they were illegal, or is it enough to suggest, as Mr. Hinton says, that they made them for the purpose of making money available so that bad loans would look like good loans? Let's suppose, hypothetically, that's what they did. There's a motion that says, all in favor of making this charitable contribution so they can use the money to bring these things current, and we now have bad loans looking like good ones, say aye. And the board said, let's do that.
Absent some facts, some particularized facts that indicate that the board knowingly and consciously and in bad faith agreed to approve of those transactions, knowing that they were somehow improper and wrong, and again, there's no such facts in this complaint, then the
hypothetical, they did it to make their financial records look better. And you're saying, assuming that's true, they were allowed to do that.
There are no specific facts that suggest that, A, that's what the board intended.
Make it a hypothetical.
Okay. Hypothetically, if this was the purpose, it's hypothetical. I don't believe that it would set forth a sufficient basis. And the reason for that is because that is not a sufficient predicate on which a court could infer that by attributing that purpose to those transactions, the board thought they were doing something wrong.
Well, one last question. I thought the standard here is whether the board faced a board confronted with a demand could not impartially react to the demand because it faces a substantial risk of liability. Is that, does the substantial risk of liability element require that the board have knowledge that what they approved was actually wrong?
Yes, in this case it does, Your Honor.
Or is it possible that under some provision of the Federal Securities Act that the board could be liable even if they didn't, by merely approving without necessarily knowing?
Your Honor, it's our position, and I think the case law makes clear, that the requisite scienter, the requisite culpable state of mind, is required in order to establish under the facts of this case that the directors confront a substantial risk of personal liability. And the reason for that is you go through the operating agreement, and as this court taught in Stone v. Ritter, you have to look at the exculpation provisions because that defines what to what extent a director might be subject to personal liability that might render it incapable of impartially considering a demand. And here that operating agreement says, board, you are exculpated except if you engage in fraudulent or illegal conduct or engage in a conscious bad faith. All of that requires scienter, and there's no such scienter here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A lot to do in 4 minutes and 10 seconds. It was asserted that the application of FAS 115 as to at least a certain set of bonds actually resulted in a determination that the bonds were undervalued. Simply not true. The company wrote down earnings of $35 million, and the actual bonds were wrote down. The increase in equity increased, but you can do that by issuing preferred shares, which in fact was done. Next, FAS 115, there's a lot of focus on FAS 115. As the complaint indicates, FAS 115 wasn't the only policy. There's no question that FAS 115 is a technical accounting standard, but the company's policy went far beyond FAS 115. The company policy, independent of FAS 115, is that it be valued by the reference of the underlying profit, that models would be used related to the expected future cash flows and or quotes from external sources. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances in this case. And again, it gets back to the fact that the board of directors here knew, because it was facially present on the annual reports they signed, that these tax-exempt bonds were performing extremely poorly, but yet only $27 million had been taken into account. So against this backdrop, what does the audit committee do? As I previously said, it reduced disclosure. That's paragraph 77 through 81 of the complaint. Another thing that I hadn't had a chance to discuss is that it actually ceased using external sources as a valuation mechanism. Not only is the external sources and evidentiary support necessary under FAS 115, it's necessary under independent policies of the company. You simply can't apply these policies without having evidentiary support and external sources as a primary one. As Justice Holland pointed out, the charitable contributions, in fact, do rise to the level of a significant red flag, independent of whether or not the complaint has sufficiently pled that they knew that it would be used for improper purposes. Against this backdrop, the increase in the amount of the charitable contributions raises a serious question and raises a red flag. Also, in connection with the charitable purposes, the only business purpose for these charitable contributions would be to support these, what are essentially holding units. They're nonprofit organizations, but they're partnership holding units. They're not partnership, they're partnership holding units. In connection with the auctions that occurred, the auctions, again, required board approval to transfer those assets in manners to the company. The company admits in the auction memorandum that affiliated entities hold the title and it owns it. These required authorization by the complete board. In fact, some assets were sold in that auction, meaning that the board of directors had to approve those transactions and giving the board knowledge of this auction process and the results. Again, it was 15%. It was $186 million in tax-exempt bonds, and the board was aware of that. I think I said what I wanted to in 4 minutes.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Rise.